So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here to present our acne experiment. There's been a number of talks about EDMs, and that covered a lot of the introductory material. So I'm going to blaze through the first 18 slides in an extremely rapid manner. So thank you, previous speakers, starting with Adam Ritz on Monday morning. So the standard model does not explain everything about particle physics. It certainly doesn't, even if it were correct for particle physics, it doesn't explain everything about physics. It doesn't even explain everything about particle physics. It doesn't explain the observed dark matter. So far, direct detection has not seen that dark matter. It doesn't explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry. The matter-antimatter asymmetry requires T violation and new sources beyond the standard model. There's something uncomfortable about the standard model, the naturalness of the Higgs mass. This could be due to perhaps supersymmetric particles, some new particles that are near the Higgs mass, fine-tuning, or maybe even extra dimensions. So a possible solution to all these is to add some new exotic particles and maybe a slightly different rule book to the system. And for example, many SUSY theories solve all of these three problems: matter, antimatter, unification, hierarchy, and the dark matter. And if these particles exist, they exist right here in this room around electrons as virtual particles. And this is something the electron kind of acts as a little antenna to pick them up. The use of precision measurements to study these virtual particles around electrons is quite well established. G-2 measurements for the electron are investigated in that diagram, and Jerry Gabrielis has spent a good portion of his career doing better and better measurements, just incredibly precise measurements of G-2. In that spirit, one can think of new particles, perhaps new SUSY particles, inducing time reversal violating electric dipole moment in the electron. You can see here, without the SUSY particles, a very symmetric electron, and here's our anti-symmetric electron. Excuse me, did I say anti-symmetric? Asymmetric electrons. Just with a first order perturbation, there's no cancellations are not inherent, and the T violating phase in SUSY, no reason it should be anything but something on the order of one. So this electric dipole moment would be aligned with the electron spin because there should be no other quantum number in the system. The EDM just itself, you don't need to know about SUSY or anything. If there's an EDM, it's inherently T violating, as other talks have pointed out. And the EDM in our experimental range would have enough T violation to explain matter-antimatter asymmetry and also indicate a new particle between 1 and 1,000 TeV, which I'll tell you what that means in detail during the talk. So one can do it as simple dimensional analysis for if such a particle were to exist. This n here is a number of loops. So n would be for n equal 1, that's a single loop. And if you do that analysis, you get EDM for the electron of 10 to the minus 25 is what you would predict for a particle of mass 100 GeV. The current limit is much smaller than that. The limit before acne ever got started was much smaller than that. In fact, 100 times that was 100 times less than this back in the envelope calculation. And so the question is, you know, what's going on? What the heck is happening? Another way to put this in context is with this plot. Here is EDM plotted here. In these units, we use electron centimeter. This is the excluded region. These two lines here represent two experiments before acne started getting going. And you can see that even before we got into the business, this naive supersymmetry was under significant pressure. I wouldn't say completely ruled out, but it looks like it had to be fine-tuned more and more. When I say naive SUSY, that's MSSM, minimal supersymmetric model. Let me see. So couple things to note. One is this limit here, which held for quite a long time, from 2002 to 2011. That was done in the group of Eugene Cummins. Dave DeMille played a large role in that, one of the collaborators in ACME. This distance from here to here represents about 50 years of experimental progress. I'll kind of give you a scale of things. There are other theories, many other theories, I'll have a different plot later that are down here, which are other extensions of the standard model. So I want to show you this because I'm going to use this later on in the talk to describe, to try to convince you that this is not only a worthwhile experiment to do, but we have very good prospects for making good progress in the future. So what I have here is the name of the experiment. This is the one-day statistical sensitivity for the EDM. And then this is the published limit, okay? And the Berkeley thallium experiment, which Dave DeMille worked on, is represented here. And then an Ed Hines group in Imperial on ytterbium fluoride is represented here. And in order to go the difference between here and here, and just in this very crude kind of way, what improvement was made was that a molecule was used going from here to here, from an atom to a molecule. Okay. This is a very important point. Thank you for bringing it up in that way. we'll get back to that. So the way that we're going to approach looking for the electron-electric dipole moment is to use this molecule, thorium oxide, in this particular state, triplet delta 1. This molecule has a quantum number that you may or may not be familiar with. This is omega, which is the projection of the angular momentum along the internuclear axis. So it's kind of like an internal quantum number, a totally valid one. There is a lab frame, MJ and J. These are switched. The lab frame angular momentum and projection of the angular momentum. So this state here, I may refer to it as the H state. It's labeled the H state. This is our EDM sensitive state. It's not the ground state of the molecule. It's actually a metastable state, which lasts a couple of milliseconds. Just as you've heard before, you use a heavy atom in this molecule in order to get the enhancement sensitivity to the EDM. So what's good about using a molecule, due to the magic of quantum mechanics and chemical bonding, there is a very high electric field in here which you can orient in the lab frame. So that's great because you're looking for an EDM, you're looking for the interaction of the electric field with the EDM, so you want a high electric field. So that's good about using a molecule. What's bad about using a molecule? Here is the Hamiltonian for the molecule. And this time here it says terms non-diagonal in S. So why on earth would you try to do a precision measurement in such a complicated laboratory? Good question. So let's just start with the basics. I'll get back to that in a bit. Let's get to the basics. Let's put the molecule in an electric field. Because of this structure of the molecule, you can polarize the molecule with a very very high polarization with very low electric field. So these fields are kind of on the order of 100 volts per centimeter. Polarization is kind of 10 to the fifth, 10 to the sixth. And in fact, we run our experiment at these two different electric field points. So it's easy to fully polarize. There are no high voltages in here at all. So if you take the molecule and you put it in an electric field, this electric field, lab frame electric field is this E in black, then your levels will split. There's this manifold here, which has the electric field pointing up for this state and the electric field pointing up in this state. But here the electron is pointing up and here the electron is pointing down. Okay, so that's what's going on this set of states. We can select which states we address. We can address these states with the electric field pointing up or these states with the electric field pointing down by using frequency selection, essentially addressing them with a laser. So we excite and probe them with a laser. And these are separated far enough apart that if we tune the laser here, we're not interacting with these. Vice versa, if we tune the laser here, we're not interacting with those. And so what that means for this explanation is that we're just going to ignore these bottom levels for the moment. Now you just have a two-level system. So you add to that an EDM. Here's the thing you add to the Hamiltonian. Here's the effective electric field dotted into the electric dipole moment of the electron. The effective electric field for this molecule is higher than any other molecule, as far as we know. It's 10 to the 11 volts per centimeter, and this has been calculated. There might be some small differences in the result, but this is very, very close. If we need to do a precision measurement of the EDM someday, we'd care about exactly whether this calculation is off by 10% or not, but at the moment we don't. So what happens to these levels? Remember these levels here, which we're addressing with our laser. due to the interaction of the EDM with the internal electric field, this one gets shifted up and this one's shifted down. If you recall what that means, that's essentially the equivalent of, this will lead to a precession of the spin of the electron in this effective electric field in the molecule. And if you were to apply a magnetic field also, then that precession would kind of add to the precession of the electron due to the interaction of the magnetic moment of the electron with the magnetic field. And so what we're looking for, and essentially it is the additional precession the electron undergoes due to the fact that you have this term in the Hamiltonian. That's the idea. So how are we going to handle these complications? Okay, and this is kind of a key idea. This thing is, it's a molecule and it's quote-unquote ugly, but it's still a quantum object. In other words, we have these different levels of the energy levels in the molecule, but they're separated far enough apart that we can really consider each level separately. Now you wonder, what am I talking about, right? I also live in the world of large polyatomic molecules, and that's not true. Large polyatomic molecules, things get congested enough so that they're all kind of sitting on top of each other, and I guess it's a quantum object, but it's starting to look really classical. But this is just a diatomic molecule, and you can really separate these levels.
So should I just think of one electron in between, or
should
I think of several?
So there's two electrons in there, but for explanatory reasons, I just use one. Okay. So how do we deal with that? It's actually the same. I should also say that all EDM experiments are essentially the same. We use a electric field reversal. So here we can measure measure this energy shift. I haven't told you exactly how yet, but we measure this energy shift on this set of states, and then we can reverse the electric field, keeping our laser frequency the same. And then what will happen is that these levels will shift in the other direction. So what that means is we can measure the precession of the spin under this configuration, that's represented here. The precession of the spin is given by the magnetic moment times the applied magnetic field plus this EDM term. And then we reverse the electric field direction and we have this, which is the same magnetic moment of the electron times the magnetic field minus the EDM term. You subtract those terms to create this thing called P minus, and you get that. This P minus has a leading term in our experiment of the EDM. These are higher order terms that have to do with, you know, the fact that this isn't, you know, perfect two-level system. There's slight differences in, for example, the G factor in the upper set of states and the lower set of states. But these are small terms. And so the idea is this term dominates, these are higher order terms, and this is what we call a parity sum. This P minus we call a parity sum. I'll use that word again later in the talk. So to create that P minus parity sum with the leading EDM term, we did what we call an E field switch. We flipped over the direction of the E field. We can also do a magnetic field switch, and we can also do what we call an N switch. Remember those two levels? The ones that I said don't worry about? The ones I said we would ignore for the moment. I'll put this in it. Yep, those. Well, we can tune our laser frequency here, and now we've done an N switch. So without changing anything else in the experiment, just addressing these, we've actually now addressing the molecule which isn't flipped over in the other direction. And so that's another switch that we can do. And so, right. And so together these form, we have eight different parity sums, and each parity sum gives you some information about the system. One of those parity sums gives you the EDM. The other parity sums can give you information actually about some of the terms in these higher order terms in this parity channel, which is really fantastic. Okay, so here's what the experiment looks like in real life. Here is a CBGB, a cryogenic buffer gas beam for thorium oxide. Molecules fly through this little tube here into the what we call the Ramsey region. Here is the inside of the buffer gas source, creating this high flux of thorium oxide molecules. And then this is the inside of this Ramsey region. And the molecules enter here, they get prepared here, they spin process, and they get measured here. I'll show you a movie in just a second. This region in here, there's a transparent electric field plate, so the electric field is pointing into the screen here. And there's an applied magnetic field, which is also pointing into the screen. So the E and B are pointing in the same direction. Here's the movie. I think. Yeah. I don't like the beginning of the movie, so. Here's the there's the beam source. Here is our interaction region where we're going to actually measure the spin precession. Those are magnetic shields which have been cut away so you can see the system. These are targets of thorium dioxide. Thorium is very well understood chemically. And there's a short pulse, a nanosecond pulse laser delivered by the laser we affectionately call the death laser. It's a high rep rate, high energy laser, which turns the thorium dioxide into thorium oxide, gets cooled by a flow of cryogenic neon, gets quote unquote skimmed off. And what we do here is we just try to enhance the number of molecules that are in one particular quantum state. It's a rotational cooling method because we're only going to use one quantum state in the experiment. So the molecules are basically piled up into a single quantum state as they enter here. And then we have to optically pump into this H state. So we shine on an optical pumping laser. The molecules all go into this H state. And then what we do is we apply polarized light, the second beam, to pump out the wrong spin orientation. So this basically orients the spin, you know, in the lab frame through optical pumping. The spin will precess due to the interaction with the magnetic field and hopefully the EDM. Now it's precessed you know, pi over 2, and we read out this precession by shining polarized light alternately in two different directions. Any molecule, if you project along one direction, you'll pump up to the C state, which will then decay and emit a photon that you collect. Then you switch very quickly the other polarization, then you pump, and then measures the projection along the other axis. And from that, you can, by measuring the number that you number of photons you get here, number of photons you get here, you can figure out where the state vector was originally. Okay, so what does that look like as far as data is concerned? So this, so again, we have two different polarizations we're pumping out. We get a number of photons with polarization in the X direction, number of photons with polarization in the Y direction. And this is the photon pulses that we get out. We very rapidly switch the polarization. So here's one polarization, the next polarization, like that. And that's what's overlaid on top of this signal. This is the time after we ablate to create the thorium oxide. And then the molecules take about 10 milliseconds to reach our interaction region. And this up and down here is simply this polarization switching that I've been talking about. Are there any questions at this point? I went over this quickly, but it's a spin precession measurement. That's the basic idea. It's a pulse. So the thing of it is that the YAG comes down, it very quickly creates thorium oxide. It takes about a millisecond for that thorium oxide to be cooled and extracted from the beam source. And so the emptying time of the cell is about a millisecond, and that's what gives you this millisecond long pulse. There's probably no advantage to doing the continuous, except that if we had this many molecules continuously, then we just have more signal. And that is a point I will bring up later on in the talk, because we are working on a different beam source now. Your limit, you may remember what we're limited as far as flux with this source, is we can only fire the YAG so every, we can only create molecules at a given rate determined by the cooling power of our cryogenic source. Okay, so any other questions at this point? So from that, one can, you know, we do a cut, cut on signal. We create what we call an asymmetry. An asymmetry is just nx minus ny divided by nx plus ny. And from this, we can extract the phase precession of the electron. And then we, you know, we bin them up. Here's a statistical distribution of our phase our EDM, what we believe the EDM to be. Didn't highlight it here, but we use a blind offset. We unblind only at the very end when we're done with all of our systematic checks. And then we use Feldman-Cousins confidence intervals to construct a limit if it's zero. Our uncertainty is limited by photon shot noise in the photodetectors. We would love to be molecule shot noise. Remember the talk you just heard. We would love to be molecule shot noise, and we certainly want to head in that direction. But right now, we're we don't have 100% efficiency in detecting our molecules. The statistical uncertainty is given by an expression you've seen before. Maybe it looks slightly different, but it's the same thing. Here's the effective electric field of the molecule. Here's the error in measuring the EDM. This is the coherence time. That's essentially the flight time between when we prepare and interrogate it. Here is then the square root of n is the photon counting rate, and there's that integration time. So this is just the square root of n, this total. So that measurement I just described to you, the statistics gave us plus or minus 4 times 10 to the minus 29 compared to the previous best measurement, which is 10 to the minus 27. What about systematics? Systematics is the name of the game. So what do we do? There's a number of things we do to try to investigate systematics. Basically, we turn knobs to see what happens. These knobs should not change the EDM, but you've got to go check. So we try different relative polarizations on our pump and probe, different global polarizations. We change the lead positions of our electric field to the lead positions of the wires going to our electric field plates, laser propagation direction, different upper states, electric field magnitudes, and three different magnetic field magnitudes. And none of them seem to matter. Not only that, but we do these searches with varying lots of other parameters in the experiment. Anything that one can imagine changing the environment of the molecules, magnetic field gradients, in every single direction, all sorts of things. They're listed here. And then here, remember, there's those different parity sums. So we have, it's more than 8 because we have one other switch, which I didn't talk about. So we have a bunch of parity sums, and what we do is we try to look for correlations. We basically vary some parameter x here, and we see how significant of a line the data represents. And when it's more than 3 sigma, we put a little dot here and say we better go investigate those things. And guess what? We went and investigated these things, and they were all understood and controlled. One of those dots took 6 months. That was an unanticipated systematic error that we had no idea what it was before we started the experiment. And that can happen, when I'm gonna make projections here on what's gonna happen in the future, that can happen at any time. You just run into a systematic and you're like, oh, there goes a year. So here's the systematic error budget listed here. Here's our statistical error. Before we unblinded, this was the answer. And now we unblinded and that's the answer. And that puts a limit of about 8.9 times 10 to the minus 29 E centimeters. Okay, so how do we interpret this a little bit? Well, here is this kind of dimensional analysis I was talking about. And part of this includes the CP violating phase, and part of it includes the mass. So it depends on where you want to stand. You want to say, okay, in Adam Ritz's talk, he was talking more about saying, let's say the mass is 1 TeV, that limits the phase. Or you can go the other way and say, okay, the phase, let's just assume it's something on the order of 1. That seems totally natural. What does that give you as a mass limit? And so that's represented here by these lines. Here's sign of the CP violating phase. Here's the mass. And so for about order of unity phase, this puts a limit on super, what we call naive, minimal, or generic SUSY of around 10 TeV for single loop. Another way of seeing what impact this has, we can make this kind of plot, which I'll use quite a bit here in kind of generic supersymmetry. Here are the names of supersymmetric particles that have been proposed. Here are the superpartner masses. And for example, the Higgs mass has made supersymmetry quote unquote unnatural. What unnatural is, all these constraints are merely indicative and subject to significant loopholes and caveats. This paper here does a pretty good job of laying out some kind of reasonable way of saying what's natural and what's not. And so what LHC has told us is that in this sector, which is these are the partners to the top, in this sector, that there's something not quite natural about supersymmetry if supersymmetry is correct. Here was the previous EDM result before ACME, and then with ACME, we're probing up around 10 TeV. This is for selectrons, and this has become also unnatural. This was essentially what Adam was also saying in slightly different words in his talk on Monday. Another way of looking at this is that one has a MSSM kind of parameter scan scatter plot. That's each one of these points. There's a kind of color gradient here. And the basic idea is the previous EDM limits had ruled out about 2/3 of this MSSM parameter space. The ACME limit excluded the 2/3 of the remaining. There's not much left to this theory. Turning it around, looking at the, you set the mass at around TV, then this is mu here, theta mu. The EDM result constrains theta mu quite a bit. This is not, doesn't have your new result, and I think this is the old result. Although I did put your new result on one of the following ones. I'm gonna skip this for time. This is new work by Matt Reese and his postdoc, Yoichiro Nakai-san. And he, this is preliminary, okay? But basically what you see here is this tan beta, the ratio of these two Higgs masses, and this is the mass of the stop now. So what I thought was, wait a second, you know, what is the EDM saying about the stop? So I would ask theorists, and finally, you know, Matt Reese said, I'll do it, I'll go ahead and do it, and they're doing it. And so for a, you know, phase on the order of pi over 2, this is now excluded region for the stop. Let that hang in the air. Here's another way of applying it. Here's the ACME 1 result, we call it, basically leaving naive supersymmetry way behind and now in the middle of split Susie land. What led to the statistical improvements? The improvement in statistical sensitivity over YBF. Remember, YBF was this experiment here. So the question is, how did we get this improvement going from here to here? One was the CBGB source, which is about a factor of 100 brighter than any other previous molecular source for things like radicals, factor of 100 to 1,000 brighter. Moving to THO had its ups and downs, but overall it gave us an improvement, and then there were some technical improvements. And that gave us about a factor of 15 improvement in sensitivity over the YBF experiment. This was the team that did it. So this is the team that did it. That was the result. And now the question is, where are kind of things going in the future? And so I will just say, and I apologize, I'm going to run over considerably, but I think I will answer a lot of the questions that I think people would ask. So here's a new Seattle result. I just put this on. I hope that it's about right. Remember, so this was the LHC stuff. This is the electron EDM region, and this is the nuclear EDM region, okay? And so that's, you know, significantly, we're now, what's happening here is now making significant impact on the naturalness of SUSY in this sector now, the hadronic sector. So the ACME has inspired a new experiment, and this is not experiment that I'm doing. This is Dave DeMille, Dave Kawal, Steve Lamoureux, and Tanya Zelovinsky in a new collaboration called Centrex. But basically the idea is to use this kind of ACME approach. This looks very similar to our ACME experiment. Use the ACME approach with thallium fluoride to do the nuclear shift moment limit. A search. And so this is the molecule thallium fluoride, and its nuclear spin precession rate is 10 to the 4 times larger than in mercury. This is a beam experiment, which has got its downsides, not as much stuff as in a cell experiment. And that experiment has been privately funded so far. The initial phase, I have to be careful, is fully funded privately, but that's just the initial phase, just to get the thing built, not to run it. And so here is the projected value for Centrex. So the ACME had some inspiration there, but we are still hard at work on ACME 2. And when I say we, the same team is continuing to work on ACME 2. Here, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to continue to do this work? First of all, some of these theories out here seem reasonable, especially split Susie. Second, there's predictions. There's actual models for the matter-antimatter asymmetry, this electroweak baryogenesis. Here's predictions in this particular model, and here's the EDM we cut down here. If we move, we're gonna be cutting further and further into this region. So that's another good reason for doing it. for the stop, which very new theory, that would put the next generation, say an order of magnitude improvement, would put the limits here. This is far beyond what LHC can reach. But these, again, is very preliminary work, and I'm sure there's much more to the story, and you will have to discuss with them about the exact details. But they're doing a fairly thorough study of this. So how are we going to go to ACME 2 from ACME 1? One thing we're going to do is we're going to change the beamline geometry, we're going to change state preparation, and then change the state readout to make improvements in all three areas. I want to make the point that these paths to improvements, a lot of them were started a long time ago. So we started, this fellow Amir Kirillov, who hasn't been with the experiment for many years, he actually did a lot of the demonstrations of some of the things that I'm talking about now. They weren't fully implemented, but to give you an idea that you kind of start some early development, and then when you actually want to put it into the experiment, there's a lot of extra work, but it kind of gives you that initial stage, demonstration stage, to say, oh, is this going to work or not? In particular, let me just point out too, the STIRAP state preparation, and then the thermochemical production. And I'll mention these further on in this talk. So what is the first thing we do is to increase the solid angle. That's pretty, quote unquote, simple. Has lots of ramifications. You move the beam source closer, you open up the collimators, and you move the field plates farther apart. It sounds really easy. It's got a lot of consequences. But that worked. We got about a factor of 8 gain in signal by doing that. Here, excuse me? Everything you do makes your systematic issues trickier. You go to the bathroom and it makes you, yeah. Maybe, we'll have to see. I haven't said much about what the exact systematics are due to limited time, but if I have some time, I'll say a little bit about that. So that's one thing. The other thing we've done is change what's going on here. We're using a different state to read it out. We were going from the H state to the C, now we're going H state to the I state, which gives us a bluer photon, which makes our PMT efficiencies up by a factor of 2. That plus light pipes gives about a factor of 5 increase in signal gain. And then we were preparing the state through optical pumping, as I mentioned. Now what we are implementing is STIRAP state preparation. STIRAP state, this is what we were doing before, which is optical pumping. You lose molecules to a bunch of states that you don't care about, and you also get this extra decay. With STIRAP, which is a coherent process, which was mentioned in one of the previous talks today, you have two lasers of two different colors, which coherently pump from a single quantum state here into, in fact, nearly the exact state that you're looking for doing the EDM measurement. This is a known technique, right? But there are absolute challenges. These are weak transitions. These wavelengths differ by a factor of 2. If you're making ultra-cold molecules, okay, fine, that's your whole life. We're doing a whole experiment. We're adding this on top of a whole experiment. Large Doppler width, large diameter molecular beam. We need a lot of power, and the interaction region's about a meter away. And so this was a really huge effort. And it was led by Chris Panda, and a lot of work by Brendan O'Leary, and then the whole team really contributed to keeping the whole thing going. And this is it. Here are our STIRAP beams now going vertically between our electric field plates. Notice how far away we are. This was a hard thing, but we got about a factor of 12 signal gain. You put that all together, and here was that pulse of light I showed you, the signal coming out. Here was ACME 1, and now this is ACME 2. And this is a log plot, and I put it on a log plot because if you put it on a linear plot, it looks like that. So that's our old Gen 1, ACME 1 signal, and this is the ACME 2 signal. And we've already started doing spin precession measurements, and we show a phase improvement in the phase sensitivity about a factor of 20, which is what you expect from shot noise. So through those three improvements, we project to get here. With ACME 2, that puts us here. That would put this limit here, this naturalness limit up here, around 30 TeV. And also, based on that preliminary theory, it puts the limit on the stop up there. But we're also working on ACME 3. Remember that thermochemical source, the second one that Amir Kirilov worked on with others? Well, we've been working on that. The chemistry of thorium is such that if you mix thorium in the solid phase and thorium dioxide in the solid phase and heat it up, you can get thorium oxide to come off in the gas phase. And so this is the molecules per second as a function of time, excuse me, as a function of temperature of the solid. And that can be compared with our ACME 2 beam source. And so if we can make little spots on this mixed target hot enough, we can get actually a fair amount of flux coming off. And we've done it. So here is that mixed target, and we shine, instead of a pulsed, a nanosecond pulse laser, we shine a CW laser and turn it on for a few milliseconds, and we get this kind of pulse coming out of our beam source compared to this pulse with the old ACME 1, ACME 2. And this shows about an order of magnitude increased flux. This is not in our ACME 2 experiment. This is not in the experiment I just showed you, that order of magnitude increase. This is for the next generation. And that was led by Elizabeth Petrick. So going to ACME 3, there's these couple of other things here I don't have time to talk about, and these are not fully demonstrated yet, but partially demonstrated. We would project over here 10 to the minus 30. That puts us up here for ACME 3, and here again with that preliminary theory which I talked about. But we're still hard at work. This guy will never stop. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he might retire one day and give his costume to somebody else. So ACME Super Duper. ACME Super Duper. Notice that we haven't done any laser cooling. We haven't done any what I would call modern AMO methods yet. We don't have anything in an optical trap. But we have a coherence time of a millisecond. There's ways of getting that coherence time a lot longer. In the next talk, you'll hear about one of those ways, which is use a different molecule, same structure, the same kind of molecular structure, but a different molecule, and getting a coherence time of a second, which it goes linearly into the sensitivity. But you can imagine applying just very simple modern methods to make the beam even more intense. And so there's ACME Super Duper, which would have this 1 PeV sensitivity. So, right. There's the team. I'll say a few words about the members of the team. Brendan O'Leary. I don't want to say the words G-E-N-I-U-S, but he's an amazing guy, understands the systematics in this experiment unbelievably well. He's leaving this week, going on, he's graduating and leaving. Nick Hutzler continues to work on the experiment. He was a graduate student, now he's a postdoc on Conklin Knees group. And he continues to contribute in great ways. This is Dave DeMille and Jerry Gabrielis, along with me, are the PIs for the experiment. Dave DeMille is from Yale, Jerry Gabrielis is from Harvard. And then this is the current crew working on the experiment. All of them have contributed quite a bit. There's a lot of stuff I did not talk about. I've got about 170 slides, and that's because each one of these people did an incredible amount of work in order to get this next generation, this now ACME 2, going. Thank you.
So are there more questions for John?
So I guess you need a couple days to run the ACME 2 to get your result, right? Your sensitivity per day. The question is, when do you anticipate coming out with the ACME 2 result?
I won't answer that, but I'll answer a question that you should have asked. So, point out, I kind of didn't say it explicitly, I'll say it now. Look at this one-day statistical sensitivity, and then look at the published limit.
Right.
Okay? Now, you can come up with whatever theory that you want, but so far the data is that this is how it runs. And so I'm always quoting a one-day statistical sensitivity here. And I think that's reasonable based on previous results. I would say that we started with an empty lab, literally nothing. And 4 years we had a result. We're now, I don't know, from when we were taking the kind of data we're now taking to the ACME 1 result, I'll just give you that data. And then it was about a year and a half. Remember, 6 months of that was on unanticipated systematic.
Will you consider any other molecule for experiment, like TAN? No.
Me? No.
No.
I won't.
Because it may give you new possibilities.
Does it have a higher electric field?
Not high electric field, but longer lifetime of excited states.
Right. When I say I won't, I mean for this experiment, for what we call ACME, molecules that have the same structure that have, let's say in the ground state or a much longer lifetime, I think are prime candidates for what we'll call the next generation, which may in fact end up running in parallel with this, which are kind of laser cooling based approaches. I see those are about 10 years down the road, something like that.
Also, keep in mind other experiments. I know you're quite busy with this one already. What I mentioned is measure tensor parity violation forces and nuclear magnetic quadrupole moment.
I'll try to keep those in mind.
Yeah, I know that you have sufficient work to do, but this TAN gives you just more possibilities.
Okay, thank you.
To do this kind of experiments. And as I told, longer lifetime excited state. Thank you.
I guess I just had a question in regards to a future experiment, maybe one actually discovers a signal, maybe one pushes this thallium fluoride effort, gets a limit or a signal in that as well. And the end of this line of inquiry is to note that there is also a 4-fermion interaction that is CP violating that contribute in the system as well. It's sometimes generically denoted by this constant C sub S.
Yes.
And so the question is that potentially there's some linear combination of contributions are constrained by these sets of measurements, and we study different systems, and if we were to know the effect of electric field extremely well, then presumably we could compare across systems, and presumably C sub S might appear in slightly different strength in the two molecules, and then we would learn about the nature of cancellations if there were such. And so I guess that's a long way of saying, what's the best way we can sharpen the calculation, the effective electric field in the molecule, and put the assessment of that in some kind of, rationalize the errors. We actually have some error bar associated with that computation.
Yeah, I'm not qualified to answer that.
Field.
I have no idea.
Now, there is little problem here because these two matrix elements of electric dipole moment and tensor interaction, they're nearly proportional to each other. They have different dependence on nuclear charge. So basically you need some molecules with heavy atoms, or just comparison of atom and molecular experiment with heavy atom have different nuclear charge. But again, they're nearly parallel. And accuracy of a calculation of a ratio is pretty high because they're with positive side and negative side. Accuracy is high, relative accuracy. So you certainly know what linear combination you are measuring. It's a positive side. Even if your molecular calculation is not so good, you know what linear combination is you are measuring. Yeah, but the negative side, they have a similar dependence, slightly different dependence on nuclear charge. If I remember, I don't remember exactly, but difference between thallium experiment, EDM, and thorium, in a linear combination is about 30%. So in principle, you can try to combine existing thallium experiment and thorium oxide experiment and get a limit on separate limit on. But you will lose about an order of magnitude in accuracy immediately because you measure two nearly parallel linear combination, which differ, one of coefficients, ratio of a coefficient differs only by 30%, if I remember correctly. But again, it was considered. It's not a new topic, but nobody wants to lose an order of magnitude. This is why it has not been published, I would say. It was considered, but nobody dared to publish separate limits. But again, this problem was addressed.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Yeah. The co-magnetometer?
It's built inside,
yeah. That's the molecule. Molecule is a co-magnetometer.
Can you do that for
you can think of it as the end switch. Right, so I can switch the N, which just changes the molecule back and forth without doing it, changing anything else.
How often do you do that?
I have the slide. I guess the N switch. We're doing this kind of pseudo random of all these switches, and I just forgot the time scale for a minute. A minute-ish. I'm only off by an order of magnitude in one direction or the other. Excuse me? Yeah, you're just running lots of pulses, and you're averaging all the time. That's correct. It's an internal molecule E. Since it's the internal molecule, it's not a significant effect. What does it really buy us? It buys us another parity sum, set of parity sums. Yeah, no, that's a good question. I kind of, in a sense, if you look at this experiment, it's really the E switch. Really, it's the dominant. Nonetheless, we've always learned something from all the other switches. I don't know if we learned something from all the other parity sums, but we've always seen something we've learned. It's a good question. I don't know exactly what it buys you. One of those is gives you the difference in the G factors between the upper set of states and the lower set of states. And I can't remember whether the B actually goes into that parity sum or not.
Yeah. Emotional magnetic field would project onto the concession field. That reversal then could in principle point that out if that were actually there.
Yeah, I interpreted the question like, what did we actually learn from the B switch?
Yeah.
So in a sense, maybe we learned, we didn't expect that and we didn't see it, but I don't know whether you call that whether we learned something. Yeah. In a few words, what it was laser beam goes through the transparent field plates, the pump and the probe. Laser beam has a polarization. It has a shape. That shape means that you have a power difference between the center of the beam and the edge. The laser beam is absorbed by the ITO coating and or the glass, which heats up the glass, so you have a temperature gradient. That in turn turns into a stress gradient because of thermal expansion. That thermal expansion gives you an ellipticity gradient due to a varying birefringence across the glass. Now you've got a varying polarization as the molecules pass through the beam. And then you need to add on two other things. One is the residual electric field on the plates plus non-adiabatic terms as you're trying to you're pumping out one state. And so you have non-adiabatic terms because this polarization is moving, and that's coupled into this stray electric field on the plates, and that gives you an effect. Once we figured it out, what we could do is just turn the laser polarization to a particular spot, and that eliminated it good enough for ACME 1. But it would not be good enough for ACME 2. So for ACME 2, we had to throw out the old plates, get an entirely new set of plates made with a different material and a thinner ITO coating. We've tested those plates, done a very careful measurement of this effect on these new plates, the ones that are currently in ACME 2, and we suppressed that effect by a factor of 20. It was only for lack of time did I not go into the systematic improvements that we made. Yeah. That's the shortest explanation I can give.
I think we should thank John. Your last talk is Will Cairncross, who talks about EMs, molecular ions.